Honorable members, honorable minister, deputy minister, commissioner of SARS, DG, Kenneth Brown. Yeah, and the rest of the delegation that is led by the minister. Well, I have a name for him, he knows, I don't call it publicly. Minister, thank you very much, and the finance family that is here, to respond or for responding to the very difficult invitation, in the sense that we have requested that we start much earlier today, and not only that we'll have to have an unusual way of handling these presentations and the strategic plans for both SARS and National Treasury because of the current program that we have in Parliament. As we speak, from 10 o'clock, EPCs will be sitting. And these honorable members are expected to be part and parcel of those EPCs, particularly because they are within the economic cluster. So we then thought, rather than to proceed and have the debate on the respective votes without having taken the strategic plans, it will be impossible for the committee. And therefore we requested the whippery that we be allowed to sit early before the EPCs starts, and we were sort of granted that we could actually stretch our meetings by 30 minutes. Basically what it means, we've got 2 hours for both presentations. Now what I have requested the minister and his team to do is that we should have both presentations simultaneously and have deliberations after that. Other members of the committee will find us on the way. I'm sure we'll introduce some levels of penalties for members who arrive late. As you said, if it was the treasurer officials, I'm sure members will be saying all sorts of things. But we'll see how we manage that. Minister is always exempted, you know. Minister, Deputy Minister, Commissioner, DG, over to you, Minister.
Good morning, Chair, and the few honourable members that are here. And I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to start, Chairperson, without the shadow being around.
The shadow wait until the sun comes up.
The shadow can't operate in the morning before the sun rises. There's no shadow.
Thank you, Chair, for accommodating us. And as you know, we're doing two presentations, one on the Treasury Strat Plan and one on the SARS Strat Plan. We are doing this at a time when we are in the last year of this administration's term of office. So I don't know how we can talk about a five-year plan, but nonetheless, we have a five-year plan to put to you. We're also making these presentations in a context where, as you know, and it's worth repeating, that where there's on the one hand a lot of gloom about the European economic recovery, which is still shaky, although less risky than previously. But even yesterday, there was still some statements being made from those quarters about whether and how for example, the banking union would work, and or wouldn't work. And this was supposed to be one of the key pillars of providing assurance to the world that Europe has begun to resolve its problems. At the same time, what is clear, Chair, certainly in the last 2 weeks of various types of meetings we've attended, both outside the country and at the World Economic Forum last week, that there's a remarkable optimism on the African continent. And that optimism is about new resource discoveries. It's about understanding that the resource boom needs to be, or the revenue emerging from that boom needs to be spent in a careful way. And there's a report from the former UN Secretary General about this question, also put on the table last week, which means that Africa is entering an interesting phase where the revenue emerging from the resource boom provides a new kind of fiscal base for many, many countries across the continent. Secondly, there's tremendous interest both within the continent and outside the continent in investment in infrastructure. Thirdly, one of the key points made by the UN Economic Commission for Africa head, Carlos Lopez, repeatedly last week, is about the narrative on Africa and, in our case, on South Africa. In other words, there are so many good things happening, but the narrative that we all want to communicate is still a very negative one. And one of the issues that, as Parliament, as the executive, and certainly our friends from the media must look at is how helpful is this negative narrative? Mr. Lopez compared Asia with Africa, for example. The level of telecommunications or mobile telecommunications penetration on Africa versus that in certain most parts of Asia. The per capita increase over the last 20 years in Africa versus most parts of Asia and a number of other indices that he mentioned as well. And I think it's in that context of optimism that we then look at South Africa itself. And the message we get about South Africa is that you have huge potential, you have excellent plans, you need to deliver upon them. And critical amongst those plans is how you improve your education system, and how you undertake the restructuring that's required to have your economy grow at a higher potential growth, what the National Development Plan indicates should be 5% a year, in order to create the jobs that are required within our own context. So the National Treasury's presentation will take you through how it connects with this National Development Plan or government objective, and what contribution it makes in this environment. The SARS presentation will look at its contribution to the fiscal dimension, its contribution to improving tax compliance in our country on a continuous basis, because we still have a significant part of our population and lots of visitors into South Africa who are not quite into the kind of tax compliance culture that we've created amongst large parts of our population. But they will also indicate, Chairperson, that our fiscal health and therefore our revenue collection capabilities also depends upon more recent trends and developments in relation to global tax compliance, the kind of mechanisms that high net worth individuals and large businesses are resorting to the renewed efforts globally to tackle what we used to call tax havens around the globe. And all of us, I'm sure, have noticed that the G7 now wants to launch, if you like, a campaign, as we would call it in the South African context, in respect of profit shifting and tax-based erosion. Nice fancy terms, but bottom line what it means is that too many big companies are shifting their profit centers to parts of the world where there's either very low tax or no tax implications, and tax-based erosion, which means that tax planning efforts by professionals in the accounting profession, in the legal profession, and others, together with the companies, is resulting in an undermining of the fiscal capability of the state. Now, this is a remarkable contradiction. That at a time when governments, both in Africa and around the world, are required to ensure that they build up their fiscal capacity, and as the IMF will call it, their fiscal buffers, at the same time, the very businesses that would say do that are the businesses, on the other hand, that practice all of these very negative and undermining tax planning, if you want to call it that, or tax avoidance stroke evasion, which undermines the fiscus as well. So with those introductory remarks, Chair, I'm going to ask the Treasury DG to make his presentation. That will be followed by the SARS Commissioner. Thank you.
Thanks, Minister. Thanks, Chairperson, and members of the committee. The Treasury's aims and objectives are summarized in this slide, and I would sort of take it that in broad terms, members of the committee are familiar with them. Primarily, the Treasury exists to develop fiscal policy frameworks and to coordinate macroeconomic policy in a manner that ensures that our economy grows. It grows in a way that's inclusive, that affords most South Africans opportunity to participate, and through that we can then be able to achieve a whole host of other objectives, including reducing income inequality and poverty. We are also responsible for ensuring that the revenues that are raised from the economy by SARS are shared and equitably and utilized effectively and in an efficient manner. But at the same time, in our desire to raise the revenue, we've got to make sure that we maintain the competitiveness of our economy relative to other parts of the globe. And of course, we promote the efficient use of resources and ensure that accountability is deepened. The strategic plan that we are presenting here, the Minister was indicating, doesn't represent a major departure in the strategic objectives that we've been pursuing, informed by the programs in large part that are listed on this slide. The new change, which is highlighted in red, is the fact that we now have a long-term plan. We now have a long-term strategic vision on which everything is anchored. We don't want to pretend as if the strat plan that we're presenting to you goes the full way to responding to the NDP, because the NDP was adopted by Cabinet only late in the budget process. Just to illustrate, the budget process for the next cycle has already started and it will finish. The first sort of big step will be the MTBPS and then the budget in March. So being adopted only in December, January, then the NDP couldn't fully be accommodated. But going forward, the budget process is going to integrate and respond more directly and fully to the NDP. Treasury is responsible for or contributes directly to four of the outcomes, 12 outcomes that guide government's strategic planning frameworks, and those are listed here. It's outcome 4, 9, 11, and 12. We contribute to these in varying degrees, some of them jointly with other departments, but others more predominantly on our own. On the economic outlook, I'll summarize it as follows. The global economic outlook, as the Minister was indicating, is a bit more positive than it was a while back. There are very good signs of strength in the U.S. economy. In fact, some would contend that if the U.S. were to resolve orderly its fiscal challenges, then it could again become a very important contributor to lifting global growth. But of course, with that, emerging market economies, China, India, amongst others, are the biggest sources of growth currently. With them growing, with the demand emanating from them, but also emanating from the African continent, we stand as South Africa a very good chance to benefit from that. It is for that reason that we focus that for this year our growth could reach 2.7% before accelerating to 3.8% in the outer years. This is significantly supported by interest rates that are at 30-year lows, gross fixed capital formation, largely by the public sector, but also some return of private sector investment. We're looking at employment improving, although unemployment remains still elevated. We noted with some appreciation the fact that SARS overcollected in the last financial year by 4 billion, partly attributed to effective and efficient administration on their part, but also attributed to some positives in terms of small and medium business sector doing better than previously or anticipated. On the economic outlook, there are some risks to the positives that I've highlighted. The European sovereign debt crisis, which systemic banking risks. We heard about Cyprus earlier this year. I've referred to the U.S. Fiscal policy issues. Oil prices rising at a time when the currency is a bit weak does give rise to what you see in the third bold bullet there of you know, put pressure on upward pressure on inflation. And of course, in a context where growth is slow, revenues fall short. Because even with the overcollection, revenue was still up some 12 billion or so below what we're projecting in February. And of course, that then does mean that the deficit outcome for 2012-13, would be marginally higher than what we projected in February, but lower than what we projected in October, which is a positive. Household indebtedness remains high at 76% of disposable income, and of course we've seen the current account widening in large part because mining output had contracted, and also at the same time prices had softened. This is the structure of the Treasury. We don't need to waste time on that. You will see in the state plan that we highlight a few changes in the organizational structure. This slide sets those out. We used to have what we called specialist functions, under which fell two big I would call them sub-programs, systems and procurement. The integrated financial management systems have been moved back to the accountant general. Those who recall a bit of history, they used to be there. We think that the processes of developing and implementing this project have reached a stage now where it needs to be married closely with financial management and accounting processes. We have created the Chief Procurement Office, and the Minister announced that an appointment of a chief procurement officer had been made. The idea here is to really beef up capacity and make sure that government can modernize its supply chain management to the extent possible, derive some efficiencies in this process. There are detailed slides on this, but I won't talk to them when we get to them. The last significant change is that we now have had approval, formal approval, and gazetting of the establishment of a government component which pulls together all the technical support initiatives that have been in different parts of the Treasury, but the bulk of them had now been concentrated under Program 8. So we switched that on this year as a standalone component. Now, the administration does what it does in this Program 1, which is supporting the department, ensuring that there is a high-performance culture. It's inculcated in the department, provides the accommodation and other means that the department needs to be able to function effectively, and also, of course, drives an agenda of ensuring that our zero tolerance stance to corruption is deepened. Program 2, which has got in it economic policy, tax and financial regulation, this is the program that is responsible for contributing to policies that are about inclusive growth and job creation that I referred to. It monitors the exchange rate and advises on the extent to which it supports or undermines competitiveness. The annual tax proposals are housed under this program. Chief among these is the proposal to introduce a youth employment tax incentive, which was announced in the budget. And of course, the Twin Peaks reforms will take yet another shape now when we publish a legislation to implement those reforms. Program 3, which is public finance and budget management. We have got three divisions that fall under this. This is where the budget gets prepared. We will be working this year with DPME in ensuring that we strengthen alignment between budgeting and the strategic outcomes of government. And of course, we will extend our analysis on long-term fiscal sustainability in order to make sure that we can contribute and enrich discussion as Parliament had requested sometime last year, I think it was. Now, on this slide, we do continue with some of the things that fall under Program 3. Many of them are familiar to you. The working with health to facilitate the development of NSI framework for financing arrangements. We've got a paper on this, and also on sort of social security reforms. And of course, these probably would be ready for publication at some point soon. The asset and liability management is the division or program that's responsible for financing our borrowing requirement. We're looking at financing some $610 billion over the next 3 years. They maintain investor relations to make sure that we're able to do this. They interact with rating agencies in a way that seeks to ensure that we protect and continually improve our rating agencies. And with debt reaching the levels that it has reached, this is a very, very important function. The financial systems and accounting, which now is the OAG plus IFMS, I've already touched on some of this. We are reviewing the Treasury regulations with the view of ensuring that where we have identified gaps, for instance, areas that need to be strengthened, such as supply chain management or capital budgeting, we can do that in this round of amending these regulations. Program 5, which is the Chief Procurement Office, I've already touched on most of what is here. The idea is to beef up the capacity of, one, have a division whose sole purpose is to ensure that government SCM works in ways that minimize opportunities for corruption, that ensures that we're able to create a database, analyze it in a way that tells us when things are going wrong, also in a way that informs how we approach procurement in ways that can ensure that some efficiency gains can be derived. The overall objective is to really modernize our supply chain management processes and professionalize it, make sure that those who ply the trade of SCM in government are capable of making sure that government derives value for every rand that it spends. The International Financial Relations Division sort of maintains or manages our relationships or interactions with the multilateral institutions or forums that are listed, BRICS, G20, IMF, you name them, both in the interest of South Africa but also in the interest of our continent. These are the programs that are kind of standalone, the civil and military pensions administered by GIPA. and there are initiatives falling under these programs to make sure that there is full automation of core payment processes for military pensions, special pensions, medical accounts, and so on. The idea is to make sure that payments can be made to the right people at the right time to ensure that those who serve the country in one form or another are not treated in a manner that's not befitting the contribution they made. Now, this is the program that will now fall under what I called GTEC. We provide technical assistance to a range of activities in government, including, for instance, the support we've provided and will continue to provide to renewable energy IPPs. Now we'll do the second round. The first round was done in the previous financial year. The neighborhood development program, which supports improvements of selected areas in urban areas and so on. And of course, we're looking at phasing in integrated city support grant. We want to drive a program that focuses on the big cities and cities as centers of growth in the period ahead, amongst other things. Now, that's the sort of quick summary of those programs. I want to conclude by just illustrating in summary form our strategic intent in the period ahead, which is to sort of demonstrate that going forward, it's not going to be really kind of business as usual, using the NDP and other government programs as a kind of launch pad. We're going to have to work very hard, doubly hard, to make sure that our economy can achieve higher levels of growth, promote employment, and indeed the NDP does provide a platform for this in terms of talking about active labor market policies, of which we think a youth tax incentive is an example, amongst other things, in addition to the Youth Employment Accord that was signed recently. And of course, we've got to do all of this in a way that ensures fiscal sustainability and improves quality of spending. We think that a lot can be achieved within the existing fiscal envelope without necessarily adding more resources, of which there is very limited scope in the period ahead. This slide just summarizes our budget. Very importantly, that operational budget line, that's the budget of the Treasury, 1.5 or 1.6 in 2012-13, if you look at the preliminary outcome, growing to 1.7 in 2013-14. That would exclude the transfers to institutions or entities that fall under our budget, which is the part below. On that note, Chairperson, thank you very much.
Thank you, DJ. I was just about to say that, Minister, that for the first time, the DG has been very economic. Second to him is Mr. Brown. Can we move to the next presentation? I saw Ivan here. Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Thanks very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, Minister of Finance and the Deputy Minister of Finance. Thank you for the opportunity to brief you on our plans to meet our mandate of delivering sustainable revenue to the fiscus, as outlined in our strategic plan and the SAS annual performance plan. So I see the DG did not introduce his team, so I will also skip that one. There are too many of them, yes. Yeah. It will take a long time, yes. the DM says we don't want to put the committee to shame because we are outnumbering you. Honorable members, our minister and the DG has provided an overview, I think, of the challenging global and domestic economic environment in which we find ourselves and which continues to place a lot of pressure on us and many other revenue authorities around the world to meet the fiscal demands of our respective countries. Honorable members, these economic conditions of subdued growth are further exacerbated from a revenue collection perspective by the proliferation of sophisticated tax avoidance and evasion schemes, which, as the minister mentioned, rob our countries of their rightful share of the tax. At the G20 summit held last month, the tax base erosion and profit shifting were key topics of discussions. And this discussion was based on the OECD report, which highlighted the potential crippling effect this can have on countries' self-sufficiency. And as the minister mentioned also, last week here in Cape Town, at the World Economic Forum on Africa, Oxfam International estimated that illicit financial outflows from Africa in the form of tax evasion and trade mispricing by extractive industries were estimated at a whopping $200 billion each year. And you might start to think that this high risk would be associated with countries that are less sophisticated and have less sophisticated financial services systems. But you will be wrong, of course, in part because of our world-class financial systems, along with the large extractive industry of mining and resources, the presence of large multinational operations and our open economy and tradable currency make South Africa to be at the height of this risk. We are currently engaged, honorable members, with a number of large multinational companies around transfer pricing over the past few years with an estimated revenue loss. And these are very few multinational companies that you are looking at, not all of them, with a revenue estimated loss of over 3 billion rand to our fiscus for those that we have looked at. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. The upcoming ministerial meeting of the OECD, taking place at the end of this month, is expected to endorse a declaration specifically on this issue and supporting the OECD's development and implementation of an action plan to address what the minister referred to as base erosion and profit shifting. Honorable Chair, the point I'm making is that over the medium term, revenue is likely to remain under significant pressure, both from an economic condition and from aggressive avoidance and evasion by both corporate and individual taxpayers. So while we may have a limited ability to affect micro economic change, our challenge, honorable members, is how we respond to the circumstances within our control. Namely, and this is how the line that our presentation is going to take, namely, how do we continue to grow the tax base and customs compliance under these conditions? How do we facilitate the conditions for faster growth by making it easier to do business with SARS and by speeding the flow of legitimate goods through our borders? And the next question that we need to, or we are going to attempt to answer through this, our strategic plan, is how do we do our work in the most cost-effective and efficient way possible so as to free up limited government resources for other critical priorities? And you will see when we get to the end of the of the presentation in terms of the resources that are available to us, and the fact that you know, revenue and government spend is under huge pressure. These, ladies and gentlemen, are the core outcomes of the SAR strategic plan, as outlined on page 21 of our strategic plan. Honourable members, you will all by now be very familiar with our continuous improvement and modernization program, which for the past 6 years have been the driving force behind our strategy to achieve the above objectives that I just mentioned. This program is nearing completion, but will continue to underpin our strategic approach for the next 2 years, and in some ways for far longer, in that we will never be finished, as you know, with the quest to find ways of improving and enhancing the way we work and the way taxpayers and traders interact with us. Honourable members, what will begin to happen over the next few years is using the foundation that we have created by modernizing our environment, we will increasingly be able to realize our vision for a more active and engaged citizenry as part of the social compact between citizens and the state. This is the true essence, honorable members, of our compliance model, in which citizens voluntarily meet their obligations in an engaged, active, and a meaningful way. To do this to us means they each need to have a relationship and an interaction with SARS. This means encouraging tax and customs compliance from the start. And this, as you know, we will do through education, through engagement, and through registration, even before they may be able or liable for tax. It also means engaging with taxpayers and others in the compliance process as partners in the tax compliance process, including working with corporate boards, which we are starting to do quite actively since you know, we have created now a capacity in the large business center. And with the help of our special advisor, Mr. Bob Head, who is a resident expert on corporate structuring and those areas, we've been able to engage corporate boards more effectively, industry bodies, practitioners, trade intermediaries, and other key stakeholders to advance tax morality. What this will require from us, ladies and gentlemen, over the next 5 years to 7 years, and being clear about the fact that, you know, SARS will always be there, irrespective of what happens. So in the next 5 years, we hope that there will be improving access and availability of our service to all citizens. And we'll do this, Chairperson, by increasing the use of mobile technology to allow easy and convenient access to services wherever anybody is. We are reviewing our branch footprint to better reach taxpayers and traders where they are located. And this is one of the most important initiatives that we have to do. Because if you want everybody to have a relationship with SARS, you have to be where the people are. So it's imperative that our branch footprint would have to expand, but strategically in terms of where the need and the return is highest. Increasing the presence of mobile offices and shared locations for those who do not have access to such technology or choose to interact face-to-face. We started with the mobile strategy long time ago. We want to increase the mobile vans that we have so that we can reach the outflung areas which happens to be uneconomical in other circumstances. We have a fixed place of operation. We'll be ensuring that all taxpayers have a relationship with SARS, and this we will do by bringing all economic activity within our purview, even when there is no revenue to be derived. This includes having sight of all informal businesses, increasing collaboration with other government departments to help achieve and maintain this, including collaboration with the Department of Home Affairs, which we are very happy to announce that that relationship is going very well. We have started to work quite effectively and collaboratively with CPIC, the Commission for Intellectual Property. What does CPIC stand for? Intellectual Property Commission. Yes. We're also working with Social Security and local and provincial government. We'll be increasing our education and engagement with taxpayers and traders throughout their lifetime. We'll also, honorable members, be ensuring that compliance is as easy, convenient, and cost-effective for all taxpayers. And we'll do this by developing a single registration process for businesses to reduce the cost of compliance. This was announced in the President's budget speech a few years back, and because of the technology platform that we didn't have, and that we have now almost able to leverage after our modernization process, the single registration process for businesses is starting to become a reality, because the base is now solidly established. Establishing, which our minister announced in the 2011 budget, a small business office within SARS to champion and coordinate our efforts to address the needs and concerns of small businesses. We'll make sure that we compartmentalize areas in our offices for specifically to cater for the needs of small businesses, working with other government departments and all other stakeholders to explore synergies in reducing administrative burdens. We'll continue, honorable members, to simplify and reduce the compliance process wherever possible. Further detail on the strategic shifts and longer-term strategic objective is provided on page 21 to 35 of our strategic plan. For now, though, allow me to briefly highlight our key priorities for the coming year, as outlined in our program of action. And you'll see on the slide there, increased custom compliance, which you will find in the strat plan on page 37 to 41, and on page 19 to 23 of our annual performance plan. And one of the key ways in which SARS supports the aims of growing the economy and creating jobs, as outlined in the NDP, is through customs compliance. Facilitating, honorable members, speedy access to global markets for South African products is a very critical economic enabler, while at the same time, effective border control must protect local industry and those who work there from an unfair competition and unwanted goods. To increase custom compliance over the next year, we plan to focus on the following key initiatives. We'll continue to roll out the Preferred Trader Program, which will allow traders who have met stringent risk mitigation conditions, those that have done that will have more rapid movement of their goods. This is called internationally accredited or authorized economic operators. And we do share in the world of customs, you know, the preferred trader program, and we exchange this certified traders across our borders. The implementation of a new custom system replacing multiple legacy systems and positioning SARS for decades to come with a cutting-edge custom solution. We'll also we'll do a review of the process of customs bond stores to enhance the control and movement of goods into and out of bonded warehouses. the implementation in collaboration with various border management agencies of the one-stop border with Mozambique, which has been on the oofing for the last 11 years, subject to ratification of the legal framework. We have done all that we could do from our side. We're now waiting for the first time on the Mozambicans to ratify their legal processes so that then we can convert Lebombo into a one-stop border. The rollout of a new improved passenger processing system to all ports of entry will also be expanding the deployment of cargo and baggage scanners at border posts. Honorable members, as part of our compliance program, which we launched last year, we have also highlighted tobacco smuggling and clothing and textile industry for special attention and intervention over the next 5 years. The ongoing trade in illicit cigarettes in South Africa, honorable members, poses a serious health risk to consumers and also results in considerable loss of revenue to the fiscus. We'll continue to focus strongly on this area during the year ahead. And some of the things that we'll be doing include improving the tracking of cigarettes in South Africa to ensure that declared quantities are accounted for at points of entry and exit, and that they are securely warehoused while in transit through the country. Enhancing collaboration with industry experts to develop targeted risk criteria for the detection of illicit cigarettes. Our clothing and textile, significant progress has been made in terms of creating an even and fairly competitive playing field between our local and international suppliers in this industry. And the key points in the strategic plan and the annual, performance plan for 2012-2013, financial year 2013-2014, sorry for the mistake, financial year include an improvement in the declaration of clothing and textile imports. After the introduction, honorable members, in November 2011 of a reference pricing tool, there has been a significant increase in the average price of specific items that are monitored against this reference prices. The modernization of the customs systems has resulted in better detection of importers who change ports of entry in an attempt to avoid the detection of under-declared consignments. So they do what we call port shopping, hopping. Focus areas for 2013 and 14 include the following: on the continued enhancement and sharpening of the price referencing tool. We'll also continue collaboration with industry to address the entire value chain of textiles. The second outcome or objectives, honorable members, is increasing tax compliance. And this you'll find in the strategic plan on page 42 to 46, and the annual plan, you'll find it on page 23 to 29. Honorable members, you will by now be well aware of the voluntary compliance model based on a balance between service, education, and enforcement. This will continue to guide our initiatives and program for the period ahead to enhance tax compliance. Our priorities, Mr. Chair, priority initiatives over the year in this area will include targeted compliance intervention in the 5 high-risk areas identified in the compliance program, which are large business and transfer pricing. Second is high net worth individuals, as the minister mentioned, and their trust that they use to minimize tax. Thirdly will be small business and their compliance. Tax practitioners is also, if you remember, as part of our focus area in the compliance program, and the construction industry. So our priority in the next year includes strengthening risk management for all textiles through, amongst others, enhanced use of third-party data, enhancing the administrative penalties process, including improving mechanisms for interacting with taxpayers who are in default, and improving the collection of administrative penalties through the agent appointment process. It is worth noting, honorable members, that the administrative penalties process is having a significant impact on compliance among individual taxpayers. Since its introduction, and thanks to this committee for facilitating the new regime of penalties, since its introduction in 2009, we have had over 560,000 taxpayers that have remedied their non-compliance in respect of submitting outstanding returns directly as a result of receiving penalties. During last year's tax season alone, an additional 1.4 million outstanding returns were received, which were 25% higher than outstanding returns submitted by the previous year, 2011 deadline. This is a very encouraging indicator that the administrative penalties that SARS impose for outstanding returns are having the desired effect of improving levels of compliance. And in the last year, we had collected over 1.5 billion rands in administrative penalties. After streamlining this process of agent appointment, we are collecting, at least for the last 2-3 months, an average of 400 million a month on administrative penalties. We'll also continue our outreach program to build a culture of fiscal citizenship, including registering all South African citizens and all businesses, including those operated by foreign nationals in South Africa, in conjunction with CPIC, Home Affairs, and local government, working with other tax jurisdictions and international groups to collaborate on global threats to compliance, including concluding agreements on the exchange of information to help identify and address transfer pricing, base erosion, and profit shifting. Improving debt management through the use of credit screening to identify low-value high volume debt. The next objective that we have, honorable members, is increasing the ease and fairness of doing business. And this you'll find on page 46 to 50 of the strategic plan and 29 to 32 of the annual performance plan. So what are we going to do to make sure that we increase the ease and fairness of doing business with SARS this year? We have modernized, and I'm very proud, and I hope that some of you would be able to go and see this new ITR 14 income tax return for companies, which we released last week. The return is a dynamic electronic return, which means that it grows according to the company's needs, and key parts of the form are pre-populated. So where the old IT 14 was a minimum of 6 pages, most micro and small businesses now only need to fill in a few minimal fields depending on their turnover and income, and the form has built-in validations and assistance to help taxpayers complete it. This new return is a quantum leap, honorable members, in simplification, and it's helping us to assess companies and identify compliance risks. And this is a real step in making it easy for small business particularly to comply. Secondly, we plan to introduce a single registration process, as I mentioned. Then we plan further monetization of VAT, including the development of a software application based on the popular e-filing application. We are also well advanced with the transformation of the tax clearance certificate system, as announced by the minister in his budget speech. And we hope that by the end of by the second half of this year, will be able to launch an automated tax clearance certificate, which would improve and remove a lot of fraud that is happening and forgery that's happening of tax clearance certificates. Finally, we are also enhancing our various electronic interaction channels for taxpayers. Our next objective, honorable members, is cost effectiveness, internal efficiency, and respectability. And this will, you'll find on page 50 to 52 of our strategic plan. And what we are planning to do this year in improving our cost effectiveness is we'll continue to collaborate with other government departments and agencies to achieve synergies and efficiencies, including supporting Home Affairs on its modernization and working with CPIC to develop and implement the single registration, as I mentioned. Combating corruption and fraud by implementing a new investigation and prosecution management system, enhancing our vetting process and raising awareness internally around ethics and integrity. We'll ensure that our people continue to perform at their peak by optimizing SAS, the SAS Learning Academy, to ensure our people have the necessary skills to meet the ever-changing needs of our organization. And moving towards concluding, Chairperson, measuring our performance, we will continue to strengthen the alignment of our performance management approach to that of government's planning, performance monitoring and evaluation approach. We hold ourselves accountable against very clear objectives and specific targets for each of these outcomes. And then finally, honorable members, we are doing this within a constrained budget environment in which our projected treasury allocation for the next 3 years are in rent amounts, 9.5 billion for 2013-14, 9.98 billion for 2014-15, and 10.3 billion for 2015-16. In percentage terms, this represents below inflation increases for each of these 3 years as follows: 4.2% this year,
4.7%. Are you complaining?
I'm just trying to demonstrate that, you know, we are leading by example. Mm?
Okay. You should have started like.
Yeah, 3.5 for the third year. In terms of our estimated headcount, honorable members, this is also expected to stay constant at around 14,800 employees over the current and next financial years, before declining approximately by 2% through natural attrition during the year 2015-16. Thank you for your patience and attention, and we look forward to your questions. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair.
Your mic, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner, I welcome you in your absence. Thanks, Irvin. Honorable members, we have received two presentations, National Treasury Strategic Plans and the South African Revenue Services. I think I have a complete delegation now, Minister. Well, the sign is risen, so the shadow can be seen. I must also then say, in the same vein, that you've been saying that you are outnumbering the committee members in your delegation. In your delegation, you are outnumbering women. I'm sure the president of the Women's League would love to have a presentation from this. women coalition. Okay. All right. Honorable members, we can now pose questions and comments, and the questions will be allocated accordingly in terms of the presentations. Honorable Van Rooyen will be the first, Honorable Harris, Madlamini, Honorable Goranwolf, and Honorable Ross. In that order. Van Rooyen?
All right, thank you very much. Let me start by welcoming the two presentations. Chair, one is tempted to pose a question that deals with the overall spending pattern of National Treasury in the light of the fact that they are a custodian of public purse. But in the interest of our presentation here, I will zoom my focus on their spending patterns on Program 3 specifically, which deals with public finance and budget management. I just want to know, because, you know, from time to time, or maybe perennially, on an annual basis, we pick up that municipalities' financial management capacity is not going, or maybe it's not improving as expected. So I just want to know, maybe the success of, or maybe the efficacy of our investment in these interventions, you know. Are we spending quite adequately to ensure that municipalities are appropriately capacitated to deal with issues of financial management? Or what is the picture here? Because I'm a bit worried. Some of them, in some of the provinces, we don't register any progress. In fact, according to the AG's assessment, there is a lot of municipalities that are not performing well in that area. And on Program 5, Chair, zooming specifically on supply chain management, as a strategic objective, is it appropriate for us to strive to minimize corruption instead of eradicating corruption? I'm not convinced that this is the right strategic objective, because we are committed as a government of the day to ensure that corruption is eradicated. But also, I find it very disturbing that as part of your supply chain management strategic objective, you don't prioritize economic empowerment and transformation. It's not cited anywhere in this strategic objective. And as we are all aware, we are looking at the supply chain management system to come in as a tool to assist us in economic empowering our people, but also to transform our approaches, you know. And maybe going back to the AG's take on the National Treasury performance, specifically on the, because the last time AG raised concern about your oversight role, but also your non-compliance to laws and regulations. How is this strategic plan going to assist us? Because I didn't capture that. How is the strategic plan going to assist us, I mean, to address these key concerns as raised by the AG? And coming to SARS, just a few questions there on the human capacity resources. I have been following with interest, I mean, articles about cases that SARS is pursuing with its employees. And some of these cases have been dragging for quite some time. And at no stage as a committee, I think, were we ever taken on board about some of these cases. But that's not my interest. My interest is how are these cases impacting on the performance of this institution? Of course, appreciating the fact that we have been obviously doing well in terms of our targets. But I think it's important for us, the committee, to know, to get an update on cases that are being pursued with your own employees. But also, Chair, I mean, this case that has made headlines about yourself, Commissioner, I think it's key that we are briefed about, because it's a serious, serious case in my take. We are briefed about this alleged accusation made about you, because at the end of the day, we are those who must come in your defense. I mean, more especially as one of the best performing institutions in the government of the day. So I think it's appropriate just we can just be updated as this committee on this disturbing reports that are being made, I mean, about the commissioner. So I think it's very important that we are taking on board. But also, I didn't capture you anywhere this time as far as on your role on building taxation capacity in the continent. I remember at some stage you seconded people to participate in the new tax forum that was established for the continent. And I didn't capture that in the strat plan. Are we still, pursuing that particular direction? I think it's important for us to know how far are we and what is it that we are committing in our strategic plan for assisting Africa to build taxation capacity. Thank you very much, Chair.
Honourable Harris.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I'll start with a question to the Minister. You will forgive the committee for being confused about the status of the Youth Employment Tax Incentive that used to be called the Youth Wage Subsidy. Given the answer that you gave us in the budget briefing this year about how there was a package of incentives coming and NEDLAC has produced an outcome that we saw a few weeks ago in the Youth Employment Accord, which I think I'd be interested in your comment on, because it not only neglects to mention the Youth Employment Tax Incentive, but actively speaks out against some of the side effects of that incentive. So what you really have now is a two-track process. You have National Treasury pushing on with this tax incentive that they first announced 3 years ago, whilst NEDLAC and the Department of Economic Development have tabled a completely separate set of ideas, which I happen to feel are relatively weak, but I would appreciate your ideas, your view on those ideas in the Youth Employment Accord and the fact that the Youth Employment Tax Incentive is not included. In this briefing last year, the Minister told us that he preferred the consensus route when it comes to implementing the youth tax incentive, because we asked why it had taken 3 years, 2.5 back then. Now, if Treasury was looking to follow the consensus route, but now you have these two different documents, what does that leave you with? I think it leaves you with a route that is not a consensus route, that simply would require Treasury to implement the Youth Employment Tax Incentive. How would that look? Is it possible for you simply to include it in the tax laws? And what is the implementation date? What is the implementation date of the tax incentive that you announced this year in the budget after first floating it 3 years ago? And then lastly, the original model was meant to cost 5 billion rand over 3 years. What is the actual figure to be the actual tax loss associated with the tax incentive that's on the table now? Then, Chair, I think many of the members will have heard concerns from business and the public about the number of senior managers that have left National Treasury. My understanding from a reply to one of my questions is that in the past year, 25 senior managers in level 13 and 14 have left National Treasury. Now, to me, that sounds like a serious exodus of skills. Why are so many senior managers leaving? What is the plan in place to replace those relatively scarce skills? And what does it say about the culture of being able to retain skills at SARS? Thirdly, Chair, we've had this long, long delay in the SANRAL project, yet there's a huge debt position taken by that parastatal. How are we servicing that debt, given that we're not making any money from e-tolls? Then, Chair, one of the main concerns expressed by rating agencies when they downgraded our country last year is that the authorities...
Point of order, Chair, if I may. I thought we were directing ourselves to the staff plan and the presentations.
Yeah, but
can you confine yourself to the strategic
plan? Well, I believe the downgrades were mentioned in the presentation, so I'm simply referring to that. The if you'd rather I didn't ask about the downgrades.
No.
Okay.
Which slide?
Chair, let me, I don't have it at my fingers, but let me reference it. I'll come back to that question.
No. Let's confine ourselves to the strategic plans of the department team. Honorable Harris, it is very, very important.
Chair, on slide, on page 7 of the annual performance plan, the compensation of employees at National Treasury is up 15%. Given the belt tightening that the Minister has called for across government, is that appropriate? And how do you explain that increase in compensation of employees, which is presumably related to hiring, but also perhaps to increases, salary increases? Chair, the one thing that was referenced in the SARS presentation last year that I can't find this year is the compliance costs per company, which was estimated at 63,000 rand last year. I might have missed it in this year's presentation, but has there been any movement in that figure? Have we done any additional research to update that figure in the compliance cost from 63,000, which this committee thought was quite high last year? On page 12 of the performance plan for SARS, it's an echo of last year, the idea that corruption has replaced crime as the number one concern for South Africans. This compromises the willingness to pay tax. I think the committee probably shares my frustration that SARS keeps identifying this, but there doesn't seem to be any movement. Can you, I mean, if this was an issue last year, it's an issue this year. What has changed? What do you do about a situation where perceptions of corruption is compromising tax payments? And are we just simply going to hear that every year? Then on the VAT registration and tax clearance certificates, I think most members get lots of queries from members of the public who are very frustrated with both of those processes. Because if we don't allow businesses to register for VAT and don't give them their tax clearance certificates, then we're cutting off economic growth before it starts. Now, I like this idea of the automated tax clearance certificate, but wouldn't it just be much simpler to allow businesses to operate and then SARS follows up with the taxpayers on the tax clearance side? And on the VAT registration side, what if you simply provide the VAT registration certificate and then follow up after the first claim? My concern is if we put this red tape before businesses can even start operating, then we're seriously constraining economic growth. Can't we be bolder on those two, on the reforms in those two areas? And then lastly, Chair, this the single registration process, which we did hear announced a few years ago. I'm encouraged that there is now some movement, but what is the time frame here? When do we expect this single registration to be completed by, given that it's already significantly delayed? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the finance family and commissioner with his family too. On program one, Chair, Honorable Minister and the DG, if I remember last year, there was some underspending on budget allocation on program one. Now, I just want to be rest assured and be comfortable that this year our planning is going to be within our right our right projections. There will be no price surprises that we have over-projected or we have under-projected on this program. And on program two, within your stretch plan on program two, Zizi, you have just highlighted a very critical point in a national agenda objective, which is the growth and job creation. But I'm more interested that within the policy that the department that you've got within your department, have you got some amendments or some additions so as to exacerbate that, because it is a national agenda. We need to achieve that. If we do have, can we share with us, because it's very important. Still on program two, I'm sure we would love to engage with the departments towards the implementation process of the carbon tax before we reach the deadline, the date of the 2015. I mean, looking at the implementation process will actually help us to understand as to how this is going to be implemented, what outcomes, what values, what disadvantages that are going with it, how to manage the process as we go forward. On program three, I know that, I am aware that our provinces somehow, somewhere, they do not have the capacity, like it was highlighted earlier on by Honorable Van Rooyen. However, though, I think it would be much better if we come out with the monitoring, Honorable Minister, because the monitoring tool, we don't see that. We haven't discussed it as to how does the department monitor those incentives, the grants. How do we monitor them, and how do they falter the provinces on the monitoring tool? If we can have that will assist us. And bridging the funding gaps within the provinces, you are talking about the census, the 2011 census outcomes. But I think we also need to look at the profitable share outcome of that 2011 census, because that is going to give us a proper population density, and by so doing, then assist the department to allocate the proper funding to a particular district. That's about program three. Program five, you highlighted another critical point about financial management capacity development in all three spheres of government. And you've been mentioning this ever since I know you, which is quite good. But it would be more important to say this is what you have done thus far, have the database. This is how to, because I've been hearing it quite a lot and it's quite good to hear it. But now let us see the move, let us see the action towards it. This is the database, this is what you've done so far. And these are still your bottlenecks, but this is how we are planning to take them forward. And coming to SARS, on the increased customer compliance towards the control and the movement of goods in and out of the bonded warehouses, I'm still waiting to see the disposal policy on that Durbanport warehouse, government warehouse, the disposal. Because the last time when we were there as the committee, we were told that the local business people during the auction are not involved in the disposals of those goods. Now, if the local people, it's not because I'm coming from KwaZulu-Natal, but if they're not benefiting from that opportunity which has been given by our government, then that is a problem. So that's why I am saying, if you see that SACU policy, have you done something about it? Are you going to do something about it? Or is it in the process of actually looking at it? That's the first one. The second one is about the cargo and the baggage scanners. That scanner I saw in Durban, it was quite expensive. And very good though. Now, if you are saying you're going to have it on the border post, And looking at what has been given to you as your budget, you'll be working under the constraints, very constrained budget. Is that possible? Have you budgeted or have you costed that? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Goranov.
Thank you. Thank
followed
you,
by Honourable Ross.
Thank you, Chairperson. On Program 3, we've heard yesterday that the vacancy rate in the civil service is almost 300,000. I just want to know whether Treasury has gathered that into their projections, what the state wage bill will do, and whether they will make sure an oversight that only those posts are being filled that will make a difference towards service delivery, and that we don't utilize that tool to say that we have growth in or less growth in unemployment, because that can seriously impact on the projections, the vacancy rate in the civil service. And then on Program 4, I see, and please correct me, for the first time I see that the debt is now projected to be 1.7. It was slightly lower, I think, in your budget speech. I just want to know, is it higher now, and that you stabilize over 40 now, not less than 40. Now, we all know what this young 28-year-old student, Thomas Herndon, did to the two eminent Harvard professors. And, you know, but for the novice... I know. Good for you. But what I want to know is it still stable at 2.8% of GDP? Because I think that's the more important figure, that, you know, debt is now at 2.8, and 2015-16, in terms of your budget speech, it will remain at 2.8, or is it going slightly higher with these new figures, if they are new figures? And then to SARS, is there anything in terms of the one-stop border post initiative? Anything planned in the next 5 years for Beitbridge? If not, why not? And, you know, we all see that north of us, our neighbors are growing between 7 and 8%, and we need to trade with them as seamless as possible. So Beitbridge becomes a very, very important hub for South Africa and in terms of business. Now, I know that you want to create this seamless movement of people, but I think SARS went a little bit too far by creating a too seamless event at Waterkloof. So I don't think that was intentional.
Honourable Ross.
Thank you, Chair. My colleague, Honourable Dibusana, mentioned the implications of...
I didn't see anything on administered prices.
No, I'm not going to speak on administered prices today.
On all the programs.
But I'd like you to join me later this afternoon, so I will be speaking on administered prices and in the energy debate at 2 o'clock. With regard to the carbon tax that my colleague has mentioned, when we addressed the European Parliament earlier this year as a delegation from South Africa, there was consensus amongst the African nations representing at the ACP Parliament that in favor of a carbon tax. I took the opportunity to caution against the carbon tax because of the unintended consequences that it might have on the economy, and I would really like, if the Minister has a bit of time, just to reflect on that. The second issue after visit to Belgium and Brussels specifically was with regards to economic partnership agreements, and we saw the termination and the date from proposed by our European colleagues with regards to quotas and duties, and that our preferential access to the markets might have an influence. What influence will that have, if you have a bit of time, Minister, on our current account and steadying the ship in terms of our deficit in this regard? Then I'd just like to take the opportunity. I think my colleague Tim Harris has made valuable proposals with regards to the sequence and boulder reforms with solving the problems in the VAT clearance and tax clearance side. But I'd also like to mention that I have been receiving excellent service from specifically Mr. Barry Hall and Mark Kinnan with regards to queries from tax. You can excuse me, sir? Is he behind me? Oh, good. It's good to see a face behind all the hard work that we do. Yes. Yes. I literally send it out the morning, and by the evening the problem is solved, and in many, many cases. I'm very grateful for that. And I think Tim's proposal that we have to look at the sequence, how can we perhaps preempt it and solve the problems before they occur, that is very valuable indeed. And then coming to local government, I'd just like to ask Mr. Brown once again with regards to the intervention, the 2162 that we have withholding the funds from municipality, what your views is, did it work or did it not work? I heard the Honourable Van Rooyen also mentioned his grave concerns with regards to local government and that we don't seem to stabilise the ship in terms of these interventions. We've seen in one province, I think it's the Free State where I come from, that there was a 70% a disclaimer rate in terms of municipalities, and we certainly have to do something. Can't we have a proposal from Treasury with regards to the appointments of the CFOs, which I believe is central to the problem, that we bring in the necessary competence? In this regard, I've been receiving wonderful service from Mr. Jan Hatang and also Mr. Brown in terms of our questions to Treasury, and I'd like to thank them. And if we can perhaps... my question then specifically, I see your intervention is with regards to selective municipalities. Can we broaden perhaps the interventions to all municipalities and see if we can get some order in that regard, especially with regards to the financial management at local government level? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the honourable members for their questions. If the colleagues in the Treasury and SARS can just be vigilant, I'll refer certain questions to them and I'll answer some myself, or the DM will also contribute. Mr. Van Rooyen's questions in relation to Programme 3, which is related to Mr. Ross's question as well, around local government. In general terms, and then the DG can work out who is going to address the numbers, because I think he's got some numbers with him. In general terms, I think it's useful to remind ourselves, Chairperson, which I've been doing for the last couple of weeks to overseas audiences, that we only have a 19-year-old democracy. That in 1994, we actually inherited, as some of you might remember, but I don't think all of us remember now, for example, 18 departments of education that had to be turned into one. Or in a place like the Eastern Cape, two homelands plus many other administrations that had to be turned into a single administration. We should also remember that local government wasn't part of the multi-party negotiating process. It followed 2 years later, the transitions that took place in local government. The elections for democratic local government actually took place a little bit later. The point I'm making here is that building capacity and building what the National Development Plan calls a capable state, which includes capable local government institutions, is a decades-long process, and if you look at other parts of the world, it's a centuries-long process. So if you look at some of the developed countries today, they are grappling at a different level, in a different form, with the question of education, for example, question of health systems and health delivery, and public services more generally. So I think it's important to keep some perspective on this question, and perhaps as a committee, following what Mr. Ross and Mr. Van Rooyen are saying, let's have a discussion at some stage. What does it mean to build a capable state? And what are the processes involved in building a capable state? Because capable state means capable people as well, who are not plentiful in South Africa. But also, building a capable state means making the right political decisions or making the right decisions at a senior administrative level, to hire people who have the right skills. And I think the mood in the country is changing. I've had interactions in the recent past with a few mayors and so on, which indicates that we are beginning to realize that employing the wrong people or the wrong skills for important jobs like a CFO, whether it's in a department or in a municipality, can become costly at the end of the day. There are also IT and other weaknesses in our system. So, for example, some municipalities don't have integrated financial management systems. The bigger ones have been able to introduce enterprise technology systems. Smaller ones haven't been able to do so. But I'll ask the Director General to also add some data, because there's a lot of work that's done to train different people within the municipal management structure, including councillors themselves. And we can give you some of those details. So Mr. Van Ryan asks, what's the efficacy of the investment? I think there's sort of gradual improvement in performance on the one hand, in the realization that we've got to do a lot more if we want to manage capable municipalities. This also relates to the question of withholding certain funds. Mr. Ross asks, does it work? It works, because where there's been non-compliance with submitting budgets or submitting financials, and where the money has been withheld, municipalities readily comply, ultimately. And so to some extent that's working, and I think the Treasury is going to do within its limited capacity. It only has, as you saw, less than 1,200 people. But within its limited capacity, we're going to intervene a lot more in areas where there is, let's say, lack of judiciousness in terms of deployment of public funds, in order that those who are involved in these matters become, A, more accountable, and what they're doing becomes more transparent. You would have noticed that we intervened in the matter of a housing tender in a certain province, Limpopo. There's lots of screaming and shouting happening, but the bottom line is, from what we've been told, the process was flawed. And if the process is flawed, and we become aware of it, we're not going to tolerate it. And within our limited capacity, we will intervene in these sorts of areas. Mr. Van Ryan's question around SCM, and he says strategic objective should be eradicate corruption. I think humanity has been trying that for a long time. And so I think let's be practical. The ambition should be to eradicate. And perhaps we send the wrong message by using the word minimize. But our intent is to fight corruption wherever we find it within our limited capability. But you've heard me say fairly loudly more recently that corruption is not a Treasury issue or a departmental issue. It's now becoming a social issue. And just like tax compliance was made a social issue and we changed the tax compliance culture in South Africa, but we've got to continue to change it, otherwise it'll come back to the old normal. In the same way, corruption has to be fought wherever we find it. And so you can be assured of our determination in this regard, but we need a lot more help. So, for example, members of the committee need to say a lot more loudly than I think they currently do, with great respect, across party lines, which is something I've also appealed to you on, that they also are going to take a vigorous view on corruption, apart from making speeches or pointing fingers, Chairperson. But what can we concretely do to create a climate where corruption is looked down upon as an economic activity, but also as a social activity? He also raises the question that we don't prioritize economic transformation and empowering. I think what you see in the slide, Mr. Van Rooyen, is, if you like, the immediate objectives of turning around procurement management rather than all of the procurement issues, because you already have legislation which looks at issues of economic transformation and empowerment, either in DTI or on the procurement side. And we will continue to enhance that where we can. Although this can't be the only instrument through which we do it, although it's a very important instrument, we concede. The Auditor General's questions around non-compliance, the Director General will address that. SARS cases dragging on, the Commissioner can address that. The the matter in relation to the commissioner, the reports in the newspaper, and so on. As you know, I've appointed two people to establish what the facts are, retired Judge Yakub and Advocate Sikakane from the Joburg Bar. I'm informed that they're about to conclude their work, and I'm hoping that either later in the week or early next week I will have a meeting with them when they will indicate when a report can be handed to me. So for now, I'm not going to comment on this matter. Let's get what the facts are, and then we will come back to the committee and certainly brief you on this. Taxation capacity on the continent, SARS is doing a lot of work in this regard. The commissioner can direct that to whomever he wants to. In relation to Mr. Harris, you've made this statement, Mr. Harris, a couple of times, but I'm not sure whether you have problems reading, because... the Deputy Minister reminds me, as I think Minister Patel reminded people in the Assembly, that the DA was a signatory to the accord package. And I quote, work with the private sector to expand the intake of young people with targeted youth support and incentives. So the word incentives is there, approved by all constituencies. So there's no two-track process, there's no two different documents. We now have consensus that there can be incentives. Legislation will be prepared. And President Zuma, in his address on Freedom Day, April 27, said the following, and I quote, "The Minister of Finance announced the youth incentive scheme in the budget vote in February, which complements this accord, the Youth Accord. The proposal will soon serve in Cabinet and later in Parliament." End of quotation. So I understand Mr. Harris's urgent need to play politics with this question, but the facts speak for themselves, and I hope he would actually just stick to the facts for now. Senior managers that have left the Treasury, again, I think there's an overstatement here, but the Director General can address that. Just for everybody's information, level 13 is at the director level. Not quite senior management in my view, but the DG will explain himself on this. In respect of SANRAL, I'm informed that there's legislation that's making its way through the NCOP and looks like it's coming back to the National Assembly. And that within the next week or two, that matter will be concluded. We will then have legal certainty on this question. And again, as you know, Chair, e-tolls has now been made a political issue. Again, let's be quite clear, because of the forthcoming elections. So at some stages, some toll roads were acceptable in some provinces. Now some leaders have decided that because there's public sentiment in some quarters in a particular direction, they will begin to back that horse and capitalize on that sentiment and jeopardize projects that actually ultimately will benefit certain areas. So in relation to SANRAL's financial stability, I'll ask the Director General to comment on the numbers, but we've made sure that it is not prejudiced any further by, as it has been, by what we consider to be very reckless comments and campaigns to undermine the institution. Then there's questions about employee costs that the Director General will handle. There's a question on compliance costs that the Commissioner can handle, unless the Deputy Minister wants to come in on that, the compliance cost question. Then you make reference to corruption and tax compliance. Well, as long as there's non-compliance and there's some corruption in whatever quarter, we're going to talk about it. You can't say that I mean, even in the British Parliament, I think I saw a headline in the last week or so about parliamentarians and their expenses and the games they play. So these sorts of things will happen, and as I said earlier on, our resolve to combat it wherever it exists is not going to be weakened, and the Commissioner can add, if he wishes to, or any of his colleagues on this particular question. Both Mr. Ross and Mr. Harris, Chair, have made reference to VAT registration and TCCs. Now, the reason why VAT registration had to be tightened up over the last, what, 5-6 years, maybe a little bit more now, is if you take the latest number, last year's number, some 139 billion rands is refunded in VAT. Just think about it. 139 billion rands is refunded in VAT. So if you add 812 to 139, we are talking about 940 odd billion rands that is collected, if you like, in gross terms. And so we are returning some 10% of that to taxpayers. If you have a loose, inverted commas, VAT registration system, as we have witnessed in the earlier years, you encourage all sorts of behavior to set up enterprises purely to obtain VAT refunds, right? And as soon as you obtain the VAT refund, you close up the enterprise and move and create another one. So how we get the balance right between facilitating the creation and operations of small business and ensuring that we protect the fiscus at a time when revenue isn't all that abundant is the difficult balance that we're trying to maintain. So I think, Chair, what would be useful is if we can get down to a more practical level in the discussion rather than talk about the principle and say, in the practice, are there certain things we could do concretely which would lighten the burden but assure us that we're not going to create an additional leakage in the VAT system, because that's the difficulty SARS has. The same applies to TCCs. There, we spend something like 200 billion on goods and services in government, say in the last year. Now, if we don't ensure that those who are doing business with government are tax compliant, what are we doing? We are actually saying it doesn't matter if you are not tax compliant on the one side. If you meet the price and other criteria in a tender, you can make money out of the state and you don't have to pay tax. And then we have to create a huge enforcement stroke compliance machinery to start chasing you after the fact. So what we are doing in that regard, as the Commissioner indicated, is to very quickly automate, and he can tell you what the time frames are. It was supposed to have been done by April this year, but there were some technical hitches. But I think some elements are already in process. So where it is possible, Chairperson, we'll certainly go out of our way to lighten the burden, compliance burden and red tape burden on businesses. And we will certainly share the ambition and intent of the committee that we do everything possible to remove red tape. But bear with us in terms of securing the fiscus. Otherwise, the Director General will be left without a job because he's got no money to spend. The single registration process, the Commissioner can handle that. The Honourable Dubuzana raised some questions about growth and employment. The Director General can address that. Two of our colleagues have raised questions about the carbon tax. Now, the carbon tax also is one of those difficult matters where we're trying to maintain a balance. On the one hand, we've given commitments to the global community that we will reduce carbon emissions and that we will do our share to fight global warming, and that the carbon tax could be one of the instruments through which we do it and change behaviors in our society and business more generally. On the other hand, it's quite clear that the carbon tax would impose certain burdens on certain types of businesses. So what we've done is to, after the first round of consultations, put into the public domain a second discussion document. The implementation is not around the corner. It's only 2015 if we get all things right. And that gives us all an adequate opportunity to continue to look at the merits of this matter, continue to find ways of mitigating untoward burdens being placed on South African businesses, and ensuring that we don't disadvantage or reduce the competitiveness of South African businesses. But at the same time, keep asking ourselves the question, does carbon tax and can carbon tax make a contribution to changing behavior as far as emissions are concerned? So that, again, is the balance we're trying to maintain. And the committee wishes a chairperson through you. We'll certainly get our officials to come and brief you on the latest discussion document. On the question of grants and the census population, the Director General and his colleagues can address that. On financial management capacity, I've addressed that question earlier, but he'll give you some numbers as well. On SARS, I think the Honourable Member should distinguish between the government warehouse and bonded warehouses. From my old knowledge, these are two different entities. Bonded warehouses is where goods come into the country, and as a business, you don't have to pay customs duty or VAT, and you can keep it in a bonded warehouse. And as you want it, you take out either the whole quantity or parts of the quantity, and when you take that quantity out, you pay your taxes as it is due. So what happens in that instance sometimes is you get naughty business happening. You put goods into bonded warehouses, and then you find a back door. And through the back door, you avoid paying your taxes. So that's case number one. Case number two is the government customs warehouse, where goods that are confiscated for one reason or another are kept. And the SARS colleagues can address the question of disposal policy that you raise. Similarly, they can answer your question on scanners as well. And the Honourable Kurnov's points around the vacancy rate of 300,000 and implications for the wage bill. We work with numbers in relation to vacancies that are funded. So any department can have whatever vacancy. If they have the money within their budget, they can hire those people, firstly. Secondly, we would certainly agree with you that the new people that are hired must be in frontline services and not admin staff, ideally, if it can be avoided, because it's nurses and doctors and teachers and similar staff, physiotherapists and pharmacists and so on, who need to, I've got to include my old profession as well, who need to be catered for in this instance. So we trust that the figure of 300,000 actually represents funded posts. But if the Director General has more information in that regard, he can take you on board in that regard. On the debt question, Mr. Schumang will answer that question. On one-stop border posts, Mr. Ho or somebody amongst his colleagues can answer that question. Your point around Waterkloof, raise it as a question if you want to, but I won't treat it as a question for now. Yeah, I know. Mr. Ross, I've addressed your question about carbon tax. And certainly concur with you that, I mean, anything we do in this regard has a plus and a minus, and it's a question of how we balance this. On the EPAs, that's a matter that Minister Davies is currently dealing with, together with colleagues from both SACU and SADC. I think they've found a new equilibrium, if you like, between ourselves and the Europeans. And there are some discussions around 2015, 2016 as the dates. But if need be, we can try and get more details. But it's a lot more peaceful process than it might have been a little while ago. Anything that minimizes exports or affects exports, obviously, is something that we don't want to happen. As you correctly point out, that will have an impact on the current account deficit, which we don't need at this point in time. Yes, sir. I think I've addressed the rest of the questions, but let me just check with the Deputy Minister what he would like to add, then the DG, and then the Commissioner to add.
Thanks, Minister. I think you dealt with the questions that I referred
to. Your salary for today, yeah?
Thank you.
In fact, before Deputy Minister, I thought the Minister was going to delegate the most difficult questions, but he has answered all difficult questions.
Thanks, Chair. No. Just to add on the issue of capacity and the matter relating to the CFOs, particularly in municipalities and departments, there is a memo currently serving before Cabinet that we just presented last week, which actually seeks to come up, and the recommendations we have made actually were found to be weaker than what Cabinet wanted, and there are very strong recommendations in relation, because we've identified that there is a causal relationship between the unfavorable audit outcomes and the level of skills, particularly in the CFOs, the manner in which, because we actually, there were some startling revelations relating to how people have actually brief legislation in terms of what the PFMA requires for the skills of and the treasury regulations of the CFOs, where people employ people without the requisite skills, but also the turnover of CFOs and the qualifications, the turnover, the movement of people from CFO positions to other positions, leaving those positions vacant, or having people in acting positions as CFOs. So there are very strong recommendations that are being taken to Cabinet, and I trust that they will also get to Parliament so that we can strengthen the legislation that relates to that, so that we do not employ people without the requisite skills, in particularly in that office, to improve the financial management side. But also the movement of senior managers from the Treasury. I think we pride ourselves also as the Treasury of actually producing the skills that other departments and other institutions actually find very useful. It is the depth of that skills that people are benefiting from. None of the people that have left the Treasury have actually gone to something below the level at which they were, because we are an endangered species. I don't think we will be able to retain all the skills, because everybody is looking for it. Every time you advise people, they say, why don't you give someone from the Treasury, because we think we will be able to strengthen that area from ourselves. So it's something that I'm not too sure how you address. There are times when you're too good, you're just too good to be able to protect yourself. Thanks, Minister.
Wanted to comment. This is a public hearing, honorable members and the media present here. We have not come up with a ruling that our phones should be off or not, but I would appeal that your phone should not disturb the proceedings in this meeting. And I've seen Linda. In your phone rang, you went out, and you started saying hello here. Now, I'm just saying that phone should, it's either you put it off or make sure that doesn't disturb the proceedings of this meeting. Thank you. DJ.
Chairperson, I have got my colleagues here, but I have noticed that time is running out, so I'll try and summarize the answers to most of the questions, and if there are any that remain, We can talk with members, and we can give written comments on some of them, to the extent that there may be some, but I'm not planning to leave any. It's easier when one person summarizes, and I hope that I will keep the standard I set earlier on. Let me talk about this capacity that at local government level. The minister's point is very relevant. I mean, local government has gone through a series of phases of reforms. The incorporation of wall-to-wall municipalities, amalgamation of some small ones into big ones to try and create more viable entities. All of those things do make it very hard to build capacity and get a working machinery over time. But for our part, without derogating from the fact that municipalities are entities that have got to run themselves. Yes, national government, provinces have got oversight responsibilities, but we can't, oversight cannot be converted into overall in charge responsible for. We can't pretend as if we can run municipalities from Pretoria. So, but we've done several things to try and overcome the capacity issues at municipal level. Amongst them was the fact that we published the competence requirements that have taken full effect actually this year. So where we spell out for certain categories of employees, particularly CFOs, for example, and municipal managers, these are the competencies that people must have in order for them to stay in those positions. That has, in actual fact, necessitated that some people must go and upgrade their skills, and or there is a sound basis for them to be advised to find other jobs so that people who are fully qualified to be in those positions can stay in them. In addition to that, for several years we've been running an internship program with local government, which we funded through some grant, which is intended to say find young people newly qualified in finance, accounting, and other relevant fields, give them a job for a while, pair them up with an experienced person, have them attend some courses, and hope that once they have the capacity, they will be inclined to live in an environment. Of course, that also takes creating an environment that they feel they can live and work in for a longer period of time. Developed a range of qualifications accredited under the National Qualifications Framework, some of them non-accredited, in areas such as asset management, accounting qualifications, and risk qualifications. Now, there are numbers attached to these. I needn't necessarily bore you with this, but in particular in relation to CFOs, in addition to defining the standards, or you can call them job specifications, we have gone as far as to develop a kind of standardized structures for CFO offices, to try and help municipalities to say, if you have got this kind of structure, you are most likely to be a successful municipality in terms of financial management and so on and so forth. Now, none of these things would work in an environment where accountability doesn't work, where people want to do things because they think they've got authority to do them, but those things fall outside their purview and stuff like that. In a hostile environment where people don't stay long and so on and so forth. So that wouldn't work. Having said that, we perhaps can do more to try and assist in this regard. What wouldn't work is us trying to be involved in appointing people, because then you kind of undermine or weaken accountability. And it amounts to micromanagement, as the honourable member suggests. So we've done all of these things. We'll continue to do them. We will do more for as long as there are gaps that are evident, drawing from the AG's report. On the AG highlighting some financial management, I mean the non-compliance stuff. I don't know, Honourable Van Rooyen, which specific one you're referring to, but the one I can remember was an issue that is not as consequential as people make it, but could be, which is people who hadn't, three employees actually, who hadn't declared business interests or something. But, I mean, that's a matter that upon investigation we saw that those are people who kind of entered the system very late, and we didn't have a mechanism
for ensuring that at intervals people who join the system are made to complete those declarations. We are implementing now an arrangement where as a new person joins, we say, look, make sure that the following things are done within X days and stuff like that. We hope that system will ensure that we comply all the time. Let me deal with this thing of people leaving, because we have had at least kind of two departures or possible departures, one's a definite one now, that have been in the public domain. Let me use the following example to illustrate that. We are one of the departments. I suspect that we plus a few institutions in government may be privileged in the sense that we have been able to keep our senior people. That's number one. Number two, we have been able to build our own people and have them join young as juniors and rise within the ranks of the organization. I'm an example of that. I joined the Treasury some 13, 14 years ago as a deputy director. Today I'm the DG. Almost all of the DDGs in this room, in fact, not almost, all of them, they never came to the Treasury as DDGs. They came at levels below that, several of them as deputy directors. Fundi, newly appointed, Tuto behind me, Tuto Shumang, who is head of liability management, came as an intend to be, actually, friend with. No, it's something that we are proud of. Okay. He's in the room behind me. Sorry. Tuto, Mr. Brown and I joined the Treasury separated by just a few weeks. So I'm saying this, that you need that perspective. But we would like to keep all the good people, all the bright people. But we also have said this to the Accountant General when he told me 2 years ago when I took my job, he said, look, at some point I would like to leave. And I said to him, give me 2 years. He did just that. Now, I couldn't when he comes to me after 2 years, because he is well known, because he was doing a great job, say, no man, can we do it another year? And still have my integrity, something like that. So the point one is making is that from time to time, we will lose good people. And you need not see that as it is a problem, the Treasury is losing people. People have got to leave. It is a natural phenomenon. It's sometimes even good for the growth of those people. There are only 10 or so DDG positions at the Treasury. After you've been a DDG for 10 years, you may be tired of the work. It's actually a good thing that you leave so that other people can then move upwards. So, and of course, we don't take a cavalier attitude to that. Look, people must leave. There are new ones. There is debt. No. But you've got to make sure that you manage it in an orderly way. You've got succession planning. You're sure that the institution continues to be strong with people leaving. I want to cement this point so that when another departure... people hear about it. It's not understood, to be the Treasury falling apart. Treasury has got 1,189 or so people. One, two, or 10 departures cannot amount to an institution falling apart.
Okay.
Now,
just summarize. Summarize so that we can...
I wanted to make sure that this point was understood. But let me just talk quickly on the other points, Chair. On the debt stuff, Mr. Schumann, I don't want to monopolize the opportunity for you. Mr. Kurinov, Honorable Kurinov, it's not new numbers. If you go to page 173 of the budget review, the 1.7 trillion is there. The debt service, the debt peaking, it's kind of a moving thing in the sense that depending on your forecast for growth, at any given point, it might be small because you get kind of a denominator effect and so on from that. Very importantly, the debt service cost number doesn't carry a lot of meaning. We put it there because there is a number attached to it,
But in an instance where a significant proportion of your debt, about 36%, is inflation-linked bonds, where interest is capitalized, you can get that number very close to zero, but your debt could be rising. So the 2.8, don't read too much into it. The growth and employment, which will be the last, second last point I will make. Essentially, maybe I will leave that for Funde to finish off with it. But the point about employment in the Treasury increasing, no, it's not going to increase by any significant numbers. All we will just care about is making sure that the 9 or 10% vacancy rate that we have, for instance, at SMS level, we reduce it. Of course, balance that against the fact that there will also be some attrition or people leaving, but we'll try and replace them as fast as possible. On the government as a whole, we expect that employment in government would only increase by 1.8% on average over the next 3 years. That's the budget that we have. I don't foresee a situation where people would employ personnel for which they don't have budgets for. I mean, Parliament wouldn't allow that to happen. You have passed a law that allocates resources which should determine how many people can employ. We may wish to expand establishments, but we can only do so relative to the resources that we have, I can imagine. Funde, just the growth and employment.
No, can I suggest we do this? If there is a need to come back, I want to give this opportunity to the commissioner. Yeah, the commissioner. So the SARS also has a bite in terms of responding to the questions.
Okay, thanks very much, Chair. The question by Honorable Van Rooyen on whether we are having problem with our human capacity or our employees' cases dragging on and on. We have almost 15,000 employees in SARS. We also have a dedicated capacity called anti-corruption and security, which has about 150 people. And as the minister mentioned, that through our hands, almost a trillion rands go through the 15,000 employees. So it's important that when those lapses happen and some people are tempted to defraud or steal some money, from the fiscus, we do have a capability to detect and act on it immediately. What are the internal processes that we have? Every employee that we have identified as having been involved in some form of misappropriation or misendeavor, we have managed up to now to be able to dismiss all of them. Our strategy is to get them out of the system so that, you know, we cut this thing, we nip it in the bud before it spreads. So internally, I think we cannot be faulted in terms of dealing decisively with such cases. Where we have a challenge, obviously, is if somebody has done anything criminal, we lay criminal charges, and those processes are up to the criminal justice system, and they tend to take a little bit longer. As an example, I mean, there's a case of one of our executives. Yes, yeah. Yes. One of them that committed fraud in 2009, and the process of the trial is only starting in September this year. And then on ATEF, on the African Tax Administration Forum, you know that we started this process of ATEF, Mr. Van Rooyen, in 2009. We have managed now, and that's why it's not in our strat plan, because ATEF is now a standalone multilateral organization, and we're happy about that. It has 36 members. It was created particularly to create capacity of tax administration on the continent. It has held over 35 technical events.
that have been successful, where they have capacitated over 600 tax administrators on the continent. So we think it's a major success. It has also facilitated mutual agreements on information sharing. It's about to facilitate a joint audit on the continent of 7 countries. So I think we have done our bit in that sense. And then on the compliance cost, I think the costs are still the same. We have just modernized, as I mentioned in my presentation, you know, our company income tax, and as I mentioned also, the new income tax return 14 that we launched last week Saturday is much more simple, especially for small businesses, as I mentioned, and we hope that would bring down the cost of people complying, especially with company returns. So that cost, we are anticipating that it will get lower. And then the minister has spoken extensively on the risk or the perception of corruption. We do taxpayer behavioral studies independently, that feedback. And as long as they continue to come back and give us the feedback, and as in his last budget speech, the minister mentioned the fact that taxpayers are still saying that as long as this perception persists, you know, it threatens voluntary compliance. Single registration, I'll ask Barry to quickly just tell us about the timelines because we want to know when this will become a reality. But the little bit that I can add is that it depends on the technology platform, on whether the CIPC platform is ready to talk to ours, is ready to talk to the DHA, and is that architectural base that we need to get right. And then on the one-stop border post, I'll ask Kosi just to add very quickly. And then the VAT registration, I think I won't add anything. The minister has spoken adequately on that thing. Disposal policy. We favor disposal policy of seized goods and illegal goods. We favor you of the policy. We do have a policy. One part of the policy is that, for example, on textile, that some of the substandard goods that come in or illegal goods, undervalued goods that we seize, if they are usable and comply with the SABS standard, we prefer to distribute that to charities that have certain criteria to them rather than to auction such goods. Others like illegal cigarettes, we literally ban them. And drugs, we destroy them according to the protocols of destroying those issues, illegal guns and so on, and any other thing that is that have come in illegally is destroyed rather than being auctioned or sold. But we'll give you that policy in time, Honorable Zamini. Kosi, on the one-stop border.
Yes, thank you, Chair. As far as Zimbabwe is concerned, we have had, I think, two informal discussions at an official level already to see whether we can get a legal framework in place for a one-stop border post there. We've quite far advanced as in developing a sort of a template legal agreement based on the learnings that we've had with the Mozambique one-stop border post. Just by the way, the Mozambique, we're just waiting on the other side for Mozambique to sign also, then we will come back for final ratification and that can then be implemented. But we're slowly making progress on developing a legal framework with Zimbabwe as well.
Barry, quickly.
Thank you, Chair. We're working with the CIPC on the single registration. In fact, we have already shared with the CIPC the data and compared data. They've given it theirs to us and we've been able to do that. Single registration is at first and foremost a SARS project to stop having product registration. Because currently if you register for VAT, we ask you questions. If you register for CIT, we ask you similar questions. So the first step of the project is actually we ask you those questions once when you register for a product at SARS, and then we inherit it From there, we are looking to have seamless integration with CIPC. If you ask me when the SARS project would be the second quarter of this financial year, 13-14, and it's as been pointed out, it depends on the technology and the integration work that we have to do with other agencies.
Thank you. Minister and honorable members, I did indicate at the beginning the time constraints that we have. I'm sure there are many follow-up questions that we'd want to pose. But also there's still more information that I think National Treasury and SARS would want to or love to share with the committee. But given the challenges we have, suffice to say probably I should give Fundi an opportunity to say something and then hand over back to Minister so that we can wrap up.
Thank you. On growth, I think very quickly, on growth and employment, our employment numbers are still 400,000 below our 2008 peak number. What we do know from our analysis is there is a very high elasticity between growth and employment in South Africa, between 0.4 and 0.7. Is the growth elasticity. So we did see in periods when South Africa was growing at relatively high levels, above 3%.
She's protected.
What the elasticity means is that for one unit of GDP growth, you will get between 0.4 or 0.7 people employed. So I know it doesn't make sense. So between half persons employed, which would be all be my size. But once you have the growth number, then the issues that relate to constraints that you have in the economy are quite important. So the skills constraint is quite an important factor. We do know for that for one high-skilled person in South Africa, you can hire two unskilled persons. So it's quite important that we deal with the skills issues. And then, of course, there are some structural issues. So we know that the agricultural sector absorbs a lot more people. So if you will get growth in agriculture, the agriculture value chain, you could have a lot more people employed. Areas like tourism, business services, and trade do respond a lot to growth in some components of manufacturing and mining. But we're very happy to come back with a full presentation on the growth and employment numbers. Thank you.
Chair, we didn't have enough time to canvass more fully some of the questions, but thank you for this opportunity. I think both institutions are quite crucial to our economic story and to the economic future of South Africa. And their plans, I think, reflect the right kind of focus. I want to end on the note that I indicated earlier on, which is changing the South African narrative. There are too many parts of the world where, you know, you have so-called terrorist incursions, but if you look at the economic narrative, we are a great destination for investment. Think about it. I can't name countries for obvious reasons. But I was with some senior economists in the last few days on the continent, and this issue came up. Compare ourselves to certain parts of the world where you have gunfights taking place all over the show, shootings taking place all over the show, incursions taking place all over the show. We don't have that in South Africa. So we've got to do a lot more, despite our political differences and the fact that there's an election coming, to demonstrate that we South Africans do have confidence in our own ability to take this economy onto a new trajectory. And that we can speak a language which, on the one hand, allows us to debate our different views, but on the other hand, projects a national positive narrative, which is going to be quite crucial to what we project outside, because people read what you say, and how you say it, and the way in which it is reported. And perceptions, as you all know, are far more important than facts in many of these things. So I'm just trying to give you some feedback on some of our more recent experiences in selling South Africa as an investment destination. Equally, if you look at the more recent case of loss of jobs in the mining industry, and look at some of the headlines in the newspaper today, you know, a firm is accused of kowtowing to government. Wow. If you can save a couple of thousand jobs by sitting around the table, how can you be accused of kowtowing? Isn't that what we want to do? Sit together as labor, government, and business and see if you can bring down number A to number B, where B is lower than A. But the headline talks about this firm kowtowing. So what's going wrong with our reportage in South Africa? We should be saying that's a great success. Yes, we don't want any job losses, ideally. But taking a big number and reducing it is a formidable success for negotiations, for the approach of sitting around a table and finding solutions. That is crucial. And that's part of the negative narrative, you see. I've met some interesting senior executives in business over the last period. And one of them gave me quite an interesting account. He says, why must this relationship between workers and bosses, so to speak, be projected as an enemy relationship? Because both are crucial to actually making an enterprise work at the end of the day. And that's part of, again, the negative narrative that we are projecting. Whereas bosses need workers and workers need bosses at the end of the day, or enterprise owners, in order to make enterprise work and therefore make our economy work at the end of the day. And so, again, there's a mindset shift that we need to make as part of the narrative shift that I'm talking about as well. So let me leave you, Chair, with that appeal. And where possible, for example, training programs, the CFO guidelines, we'll try and go through the questions where we can find additional policy documents that might be of use to you. In the next 2 weeks, we'll get them to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honorable members, I think we've come to the end of our deliberations. Any further prolonging of this sitting, it might be deemed to be an illegal gathering. But we will. Thank you very much.
He did, yeah.
How long
did he? Well, he spoke for about 20 minutes. So it's worth just about 20 minutes. So.
Well,
let me get it for you. Let me save this one first.
EPCs, EPCs, not going to EPCs.
Well, there's an overview. I think it's important you have it.
Okay.
I'm going to let you listen to it just now. I think you're going to listen. Why don't you put the headphones on the casual?
Yeah.
This computer doesn't have very powerful speakers.
Yeah, but you, when did you buy?
2000.
Yeah, okay. So then they will.
The only thing I can do, I can give you. Load that on to your device.
No, no, no. Compared to the neighborhood.
Could you just forward a bit, because I think the chairperson's going on and on.
Okay. Well, look, this is...
Here we go.
Okay. I'll let you listen to get a cup of tea.
Sorry?
You want a cup of tea or something?
Okay. Okay. Thank you.